Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening. Welcome to Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak. We've got some amazing guests tonight. All good, solid progressives. We've got Steve Perman, running for District 78. We've got Diana Demarest, a very powerful progressive campaigner, political activist. We've got Kristen Jacobs, running for District 2, candidate, a real good, solid progressive, lots of great experience. And Mario Piscatella, a campaign professional, political activist, and solid progressive. So it's going to be a great show, and I'm glad you joined us. On behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce, we want to welcome you. And I also do want to remind you there's some excellent other shows on the Progressive Talk Circuit, and I want to encourage you to follow them. Gwen Holden-Berry with her Here Be Monsters, excellent show. Brian Stetton's program, Progress Toward Democracy, and also the Susan Nylon Show over in the Sarasota area, and also available online. An excellent show, all excellent progressive hosts, and you should definitely take advantage of what they're doing, bring some good voices to the air. Some of the news items I want to cover. remember the FEC, Federal Election Commission, you know how it protects us and logs all those big money expenditures, the ones that, you know, can't slip through those big loopholes. But it turns out, even though they've been the go-to source for tracking political money, turns out that they've actually, after January of this year, the FEC deleted a whole set of contributions totaling millions of dollars made during the 2007-2008 election cycle. Most important, these files concern what's now called dark money. It's like dark matter. Funds donated to ostensible charities or public interest groups rather than parties, candidates, or conventional political action committees. These nonprofit groups, which Washington insiders often refer to generically as 501(c)s, after the section of the federal tax code that relates them, use the money to pay for allegedly educational independent ads that run outside the conventional campaign channels. Well, you know, that data gets untidy and, oh, it takes up so much space. It was getting dusty and everything, so they just deleted it. Why the FEC was created. Federal regulatory agencies are often the offspring of epic scandals. The Federal Election Commission is no exception. It was created after the aftermath of Watergate to do for political money what the Securities and Exchange Commission did for securities markets after the New Deal. And then anything goes, wild child saturnalia of corruption through a mix of tough new regulations and sunlight, you know, the ultimate disinfectant. The FEC was supposed to inform the public and curb abuses in our democracy, but like the SEC in the post-Reagan era, the FEC's reach soon exceeded its grasp. Virtually from the beginning, dark forces of law and politics combined to render the agency almost impotent as a regulator. Today, a generation of legal loopholes, court decisions, and bipartisan foot-dragging has wrecked the spending limits, destroyed the promise of public funding, and spawned a new gilded age of money in politics. How do you spell Coke? And Crossroads GPS. On the Fukushima front, always an important front where you won't get the news anywhere else. From E&E Energy News, nuclear operator will be releasing secret Fukushima tapes. Former Prime Minister Naoto Kan, who was in office during the Fukushima nuclear meltdown, has told ABC he believes the plant operators have been hiding key evidence. TEPCO now says it will bow to months of pressure from Mr. Kan and the government and release many hours of teleconference video taken in the days after the year's meltdown. It's confirmed crucial audio of heated exchanges with Mr. Kan is missing. Oh, where's Rosemary Woods when she's really needed? Claiming the hard drive was full. Especially those really touchy subjects. Mr. Kan has described the missing audio of his speech as extremely strange. The speech was filmed and broadcast to all TEPCO sites. Surely they recorded the sound at one of those sites. It would seem to appear the company is trying to hide something. And speaking of hiding something, one of the contractors has been sending people inside the plant to add insulation to some of the pipes, told its employees to please slip these lead covers over your dosimeters because, you know, if the radiation on your dosimeters is too high, you won't be able to work here. And we know you want your job, so protect that dosimeter with lead. Here, have some lead. And, of course, that did great things for the dosimeters, not so much for the operators. Oh, and by the way, it seems there's a shortage of people to work on that plant. Wonder why. Wonder, wonder, wonder. Some of the workers in the company are really upset. They're angry. And often they use violence, a reporter has found out. He was lucky to hear about it because to talk to his boss. If you're worried about radiation, you're not suitable to be a nuclear worker. The NHK video has captured on-screen captions in English. It talks about the fact that there's a hot spot in the ocean south of Fukushima. However, it's almost directly in front of the Tokai nuclear power plant. So let's see, is this Fukushima spreading its wealth or Tokai making releases that they just haven't, you know, told anybody about? Who knows? Hopefully the scientists will actually get there before they clamp down on that information. Okay, next up. The Electronic Freedom Foundation has urged Congress to protect the privacy of face recognition software. Today, EFF attorney Jennifer Lynch urged Congress to limit collection of biometrics and protect privacy with respect to the use of face recognition technology, EFF Electronic Freedom Foundation. Jennifer's testimony, there's a PDF available at the EFF site, in a Senate hearing on what facial recognition technology means for privacy and civil liberties. Basically, it means that they can track your face. Anytime you put up a photo, they can identify it, they can link it to all the other places they can find it, and consequently, privacy takes another hit. Okay, a pressing issue because, as we've noted, the FBI and Department of Homeland Security are already incorporating face recognition technology into their extensive biometric database, which is accessible in real time by state and local law enforcement, Department of Defense, State Department, and other federal agencies. On the Affordable Care Act front, now the Supreme Court's upheld Affordable Care. Former insurance company exec Wendell Potter seems to be appealing the single-payer advocates to bury the hatchet. His call is to just go along, get along. Potter, the whistleblower, who was featured prominently in the Michael Moore film. Now, he calls on proponents of more comprehensive reform to forgive and forget and embrace the concessions made by the Obama administration. But there's some gaping holes in his thinking. First, this is from a story in Fire Dog Lake. First, insurers hardly need to rely on single-payer movement to sabotage elements of the law they don't like. They'll have office towers full of high-priced lawyers who are adept at identifying loopholes. Second, let's not have any illusions about ACA. Before he was elected, President Obama was an advocate of single-payer when he was in the Senate, calling on progressives to push him. Instead, most liberals decided to reduce themselves to cheerleading while all the pressure came from the right. So when the health care bill was introduced, the president, along with the active encouragement of groups like Health Care for America Now, blocked the single payer from consideration, persuading people through consent rather than coercion to accept inadequate solutions for the societal needs that has long been a key feature of the neoliberal agenda. To get any airing from Senator Max Baucus, who was running the Senate side of the debate, nurses, doctors, and single payer health care activists had to literally get arrested in the Senate Finance Committee hearing. On the House side, Democrats who proposed single-payer amendment endured heavy-handed threats from then-White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel. Meanwhile, then-Press Secretary Robert Gibbs publicly attacked the professional left, who will only be satisfied when we have Canadian health care and we've eliminated the Pentagon. Now, that's certainly common measured speech. This should come as no surprise that negotiating with your supporters before engaging in political opposition and lecturing, hectoring, and seeking to silence health care activists who've worked for years for real reform, Obama and Democrats ended up with a weaker bill. Okay, more on that also at Fire Dog Lake. Another front, a subcontractor of Japan's crippled Fukushima plant told workers to lie about their exposure. And ladies and gentlemen, we've got our first guest. I think we've got Mr. Steve Perlman. Good evening, is this Steve?
It is. How are you, Rick?
Very good, sir. Very good. Welcome. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, let me ask you first. I want to congratulate you on your campaign and wish you all the luck.
Thank you very much.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the committee work that you've been doing, and give us some sense of the action that you've worked on in the House so far.
Well, that would be my pleasure. And if I may, Rick, just a clarification for your listeners.
Sure.
You had mentioned that I was a candidate for House 78. I'm actually the incumbent state representative for House 78. But with redistricting, the actual district I'm running for is 81.
Oh, 81. I see.
Yeah,
sorry
no problem.
About that. Sorry
Not
about
at
that.
All. Not at all. Well, my committee work, as the only physician-level provider in the minority caucus, I'm the ranking member on the Health Access Subcommittee. I also serve on the full Committee for Economic Affairs, which is all the business-related bills that pass through the House. And I serve on three committees related to agriculture and natural resources, which are the Ag and Natural Resource Policy, Ag and Natural Resource Appropriations, and the Select Committee for Water Policy for the state.
Wow, that's a real important. Those are all very important areas. Gosh, I hate to ask you to talk about one or two of those because clearly you could talk for a while about it. Which would you prefer to talk about? Health, I guess. Health access.
Well, the main thing I accomplished in health has to do with a language I contributed to the nursing home diversion program in Medicaid, which allows low-income seniors to actually receive their nursing services at home instead of being institutionalized. It allows
sounds like
these
a real
seniors,
cost-effective idea.
It really is. It actually, when fully implemented, will save the state $1.2 billion and at the same time allow seniors to age with dignity at home instead of being institutionalized.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. So obviously there was a lot of opposition.
You know, I didn't vote for the overall Medicaid bill because, you know, the majority-sponsored Medicaid bill had way too many cuts into too many programs. I'm just gratified, since it was going to pass the majority vote anyway, even without my vote for it, that I was able to get that really powerful and productive language in.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations, sir.
Thanks.
And you know, since, unfortunately, senior issues don't get much coverage broadly in the press, I'm sure that was a largely unrecognized, except by the people who are going to benefit, and you did really good there. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You know, it must be heartbreaking for you as a medical professional to sit there and hear these incredible cuts that are being, I guess, passed, I suppose, is the nicest thing you can say about it, and laid upon the Florida constituents. Could you talk a little bit about the Republican agendas?
Well, sure. I mean, first of all, I have always believed that a society is judged by how it cares for those least able to care for themselves. And
sure.
In this society, it's children and seniors. So the deep cuts that come across in the Medicaid budget and in other healthcare-related things are a disappointment for me as a provider, because at the end of the day, all we're trying to do is help people. And there are aspects of the majority agenda that don't really look very people-centered. It seems like it's the Democrats in the back two rows that do all the screaming on behalf of the people that don't have enough of a voice up there.
Wow, that's great. You know, one of the important issues always here in Florida is our natural resources. We couldn't have the tourist base that so much of our economy depends on if we didn't have water that you could swim in, water that you could drink, natural resources. Could you talk a little bit about the interesting Republican agenda to fight for dirty water and fight for the ability to dirty air?
As much as we love to throw red meat to the audience to, like, despise the Republicans, I would rather let your audience know that I got a landmark bill through that actually benefits everybody with in terms of having access to more fresh water. My bill last session that I was able to pass unanimously, it had no opposition, not
wow.
from agriculture, not from the environment, from no one, now allows water management and landowners, the ranchers and farmers, to partner up to store fresh water on the land without the farmers and ranchers risking losing their property rights. So now, for the first time, we'll really be able to recharge the aquifers and to have a much better and more consistent supply of fresh water.
Well, that's absolutely important. You can't have people, you can't have wildlife without water, that's for sure.
That's right.
By the way,
I also was able to pass a bill that designates April 7th every year as Everglades Day. So now people will really be able to have a statewide recognition of just how important that vital natural resource is.
Well, that's awesome. I always like to ask my guests to talk about themselves a little bit. Life is complicated enough. If you have friends, you have family, you have children, making a living and dealing, well with your family takes so much time. And when somebody makes the extra effort to participate in society, to try to make it a better world, I think that's important for my guests, my listeners to understand. Could you talk a little bit about what was it in your life that made you step up and try to contribute and step up to take the time and effort to try to make this a better world?
Wow, that's what a wonderful question. I'm happy to respond to it. I'm a chiropractic physician, and for 17 years, from 1994 through 2010, I volunteered my time up in Washington on Capitol Hill, aggressively lobbying as an unpaid lobbyist on behalf of healthcare issues, Medicare, graduate student loans, DOD and VA, meaning our active and retired military personnel getting great healthcare. And all the friends I made on Capitol Hill in Congress all told me that with my passion and understanding of the issues, I should be on the other side of the desk. So I finally made the decision to run for office, and thank goodness I've had the privilege of serving the citizens of Florida as a state representative.
Oh, that's great. That's a wonderful story. Let me ask you this. If you were to say, when you go back, hopefully as a elected incumbent, when you go back, what's top three items on your list? What are you going to try to work on most? Do you have a short list of an agenda that you'd really like to see achieved?
Sure, well, I really do. I mean, listen, everyone's feeling economic stress. I want to make sure that any additional attempts by the majority party to reduce revenue by cutting taxes has to translate directly into job creation. We want jobs. We want people back to work, and we want people stimulating their local economies by earning salary and being able to spend it in their communities. So job creation, stimulating the economy is right at the top of my list. I also want to fight for affordable and accessible health care, because I see too many people struggling financially by not being able to go to the doctor or not being able to take good care of themselves and their families. And as Americans, we should not have to make that sacrifice. We should be able to get good quality health care. I also want to make sure I continue to protect our kids and seniors. That's a big priority for me. And really, in the grand scheme of things, I just want to advance democratic quality principles. Fund our public schools, make sure that that the labor force is protected. I really want to make sure that I represent my constituency in the most responsible way possible.
Well, that sounds wonderful. With that great achievement that you made for storing up additional water, do you have any water policy projects in mind?
Well, Florida is flat. It's been designed to drain. And as a result, 3.5 billion gallons of usable water flows out to the tides every single day. But now with 18 million people, we need to find ways to intelligently retain and reuse water and not waste it. So I'm very big on water conservation. I'm very big on them finding ways to not just let water flow out to the tides, but rather to reuse water for other purposes so it doesn't go to waste. And those are bills that I've already worked on and ones that I'll continue to work on moving forward.
Oh, that's great. For quite some time, there was a large push for deep injection wells to place waste products rather than do a lot of treatment to just pump them deep down. Have you seen any studies on how that's worked? We constantly are hearing about the problems with fracking, where
yes,
they're pumping all kinds of poisonous stuff down there. We yes, obviously don't have natural gas below, but we've been pumping a lot of waste down there. What can you say anything about that issue?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say about it, overall, just as an overview, this planet is on loan to us by future generations. our kids, our grandkids, we've got to be responsible stewards and make sure that we're making intelligent decisions that are not just short-term solutions, but longer-term solutions. It's one of the reasons why on my own personal agenda, I've already sponsored bills and will continue to sponsor bills on alternative and reusable energy sources. It's irresponsible to pump garbage down into the earth. We simply have to find intelligent ways to recycle and intelligent ways to not poison our planet, because as I said, we're responsible to our future generations to keep it healthy.
It sounds like it'd be a lot more fiscally responsible to treat it right the first time rather than to solve a problem later.
Well, that's true. And what we find very often is quick fixes usually end up giving us bigger problems down the road. I think that Florida needs an intelligent energy portfolio regarding diversification into wind, solar, biomass, and other reusable fuels, and not to be dependent on drilling for natural gas and oil. Even though those are options for us, they should not be our only options.
I've had the pleasure of living in the state since 1967. I've heard it called the Sunshine State probably once a day for 50 years almost. It always astounded me that we're not taking more use of electric photoelectric power and solar power. Do you see? I know FPNL has been making some roads in that direction. When you're interested in alternative energy, do you see any changes in that arena?
Well, I do. I mean, in Indian Town, which is part of my current district but won't be part of the district I'm running for re-election for, they already have a big solar field FPL in that area. And actually, solar power has gotten much more reasonable because the technology has improved to the point that those photoelectric cells are much more reasonably priced. But we have to be intelligent. I mean, we look at a country like Germany that uses the walls that are along the sound walls, along their highways out there. They cover them with solar cells. I mean, there's no footprint to that. It's things that are already in place that just by putting a photoelectric cell on them, they're using that energy to create power on all the highways in Germany. Wouldn't that be an intelligent thing to consider here in the U.S.?
Absolutely. I understand they also have turbines underneath overpasses to get the wind motion from those cars as well.
Yes, there really are great innovators out there with great ideas. The problem, as always, is you have to advance it through the process of legislation, and that is where all the different special interests weigh in. Isn't there a joke about a camel is a horse designed by a committee?
Sure.
a bill starts out looking good, and then it morphs into something else. But absolutely, there are great questions to be asked and great answers to be discovered on alternative energy here in Florida.
Let me ask you a question related to your Everglades interests. Some time ago, there was talk about a land sale from the sugar industry in the central part of Florida, and there was some back and forth on. Where does that stand now? It's sort of disappeared from the news.
Well, the original deal, the way they designed it, didn't really go through. And I need to tell you that because agriculture is such a critically important economic driver for Florida, I myself want to make sure that that the agricultural interests, as long as they're responsible about the use of the land, which I believe they're making every effort to be responsible about, waste products that the farming interests generate. The idea of trying to restore the Everglades to what it was 100 years ago is really, I don't think it's realistic in the short term. I do think that the combination of intelligent use of the agricultural land and heightened awareness by the public and by all the interested parties regarding restoration of the Everglades is one that is going to pick up a lot of steam over the next couple of years as more and more people realize that this is a resource that everyone in Florida is depending on, and we really have to work together to make sure that that everyone's interest is being considered when it comes to the Everglades. But that original sugar deal you're describing did not go through the way they originally had intended it to, and that was actually something that Governor Crist was working on. But the deal as it was originally designed pretty much fell apart.
Okay. If I could ask you one more economic question, and I apologize because it's not going to be a short answer. so many of us are feeling victimized by the whole insurance situation. People are being canceled across the state. They're looking for alternatives. We hear that on the one hand, Citizens has been limited to X amount of growth, but they're gaming their approach so that they can charge more and more. Almost everybody I know has heard either themselves had to deal with a cancellation, or they know people that are. Do you have any sense of what's going on with this the whole insurance situation and Citizens?
Yeah, I sure do. I mean, listen, Citizens was designed to be an insurance of last resort. But right now, because there are so few policies being offered by private insurers, that Citizens is really oversubscribed. And let's face it, Rick, Citizens is us. If there's a 1-in-100-year storm that devastates Florida, it's all of us, the taxpayers, that are backing up Citizens. But we have to responsibly find a way to move people out of Citizens, not do what they tried to do this last session and push people into surplus lines coverage, which really is not intelligent coverage for the average consumer. My idea is to find a way to get the insurance carriers to not cherry-pick the coverages they offer in the state. What I mean by that is, instead of just doing something profitable like car insurance or life insurance or health insurance, if these companies offer property coverages in other states, they should be encouraged to offer those policies here, and as soon as there are more policies from more companies being offered, it will in fact stimulate the marketplace and people will be able to move from Citizens into other coverages for a reasonable cost.
I had a chance to talk with one of the major insurance executives in South Florida about a year ago, and I happen to be in the internet marketing business, and I do web media, so it was in that context. The company I was working with had asked me to sit in this meeting to talk about marketing, but one of the things that he said really kind of set me back. I've been around for a while. I've heard almost every business story that you can imagine. I thought I had anyway, but he made a comment that really surprised me. He was talking about his business, and he said, well, you know, there'll be a certain amount of breakage. And I thought, well, you know, if you manufacture widgets, a widget breaks. You manufacture glass, a glass breaks. You manufacture cars, a car breaks. What the heck did he mean by every once in a while there'll be some limited breakage? So I asked my business colleague, the people that invited me to the meeting, and they said, they just laughed. And they said, well, in the insurance arena, breakage means, well, they actually have to pay you something. And I thought, oh my goodness, what call me naive, but it sounds awfully cynical to me.
Let me respond to that this way, Rick. First of all, keep in mind that insurance companies are in the premium collecting business, not the benefit paying business. they want checks coming in, not checks going out, and that's the nature of their business. But keep in mind, buying insurance is basically a wager. You're betting the insurance company that if you have a problem, they've got to pay you back multiples of what you've given them, and they're betting that you won't have a problem or that your policy will expire before they have to pay you any money. So if you look at it that way, you can understand the nature of that business, and that is to basically, you know, you're taking bets, and it's a necessary evil because, you know, we have mortgages, we have to protect our property, but the insurance company at the end of the day, if they're in business to keep more money in, then they have to pay back out. So I guess when he refers to breakage, it means, yes, there are claims we have to pay. That's the nature of the contract.
Well, it strikes me that since we live in Florida and the people that live in Florida get to deal with hurricanes and tornadoes, but it strikes me that no matter what part of the country you pick on, they're dealing with something. And, you know, maybe we need to think of a better way to make this work than guaranteeing these folks extraordinary, exemplary profits. But I guess we can see from the news that not all these insurance things work out so well for them. Well, listen, Steve, is there anything else you want to say in kind of summing up? What is your – do you have a campaign slogan or you have a campaign mission? What would you say it is?
I sure do. My campaign website is www.believeinsteve.com. And your listeners can go to believeinsteve.com. They can learn more about me, look at the various issues I've worked on. They can volunteer for my campaign. They can see who I've been endorsed by. The list is growing every single day. And I just hope your listeners, especially those who live in District 81, which is basically everything in Palm Beach County west of the Turnpike, I would like very much to continue to serve in my capacity as a state rep. And I'd like to thank you and Mickey very much for inviting me onto the air. It's been a great visit with you.
Well, thank you so much, and best of luck with your campaign, sir.
Thank you, Rick.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now.
Okay. Well, that was informative. It's good to know about the incumbent, Mr. Steve Perman, who's running for District 81. Okay. Now, our next guest should be on in just a minute. Meanwhile, let's go back to the news while we're waiting. We've got some more interesting information on the ongoing case of the Bradley Manning case. As you know, he's still fighting for his day in court, and it looks like our guest has just arrived, so I'm going to put this aside for now. Don't forget, there's more news on the Bradley Manning and Julian Assange case coming up. Good evening. Is this Diana?
Oh, good evening, Rick. How are you?
Very good. Very good. So nice to have you back.
Thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
Well, I know you're just busy as heck. You want to share some of what you're working on right now with our listeners?
Number one, I am working on a campaign of your previous guest, Steve Perman. Steve Perman is a wonderful representative. He's done a great job up there in Tallahassee, and I want to do everything I can to send him back. Our opponent has basically been painted by the Palm Beach Post as a seat shopper. This is a person who has jumped into five different seats in two election cycles.
Really
and,
committed, huh?
Yeah, and quite frankly, you know, I want a person, and I don't live in Steve's district. I live in further north and further west of where he represents. But if I'm going to send somebody to Tallahassee, I want to make sure that they're going to do everything they can to work for the people and do what's right by the people and not lining their own pockets. And here I have a guy who doesn't really care about the people, in my opinion, because he jumps from seat to seat where it's convenient for him to run, and quite frankly, he's being pulled by the insurance industry. This is a former State House representative who was with the insurance industry and, quite frankly, voted up on every increase bill, every deregulation bill in insurance that there could possibly be offered on the planet. And you know, that hurts families, that hurts seniors. That hurts everybody, and, you know, he makes great commissions on the deal, and it's great for his industry, but it's not good for us.
Yeah, it's a shame that people who get involved in the process have an agenda other than serving as the civil servants that we hope they are. If you were to say the one thing that makes Steve Perman the ideal candidate, or what would you say his best strength is?
He cares about real people. He lives in that district. He owns a business in that district. He's on the ground with people. He sees patients every day, mostly seniors for chiropractic services, and he cares about people. And to me, that's why we send you to Tallahassee, is to take care of the people, not to pander to special interests like lobbyists and insurance lobbyists and anybody that's going to do a payoff or line pockets, because that's not what government is. Government is supposed to be by the people, for the people, and, you know, we have some folks running that, aren't of that caliber, and I think Steve Perman, first and foremost, cares about people, and that, to me, is very important.
Well, you
so
know,
he's
one
race.
One of the things that he said that really impressed me was in this very partisan, polemic situation we have in Florida government, he was able to achieve some things that are clearly going to benefit Florida in the long run. His success with the seniors getting able to get care in their homes, and also that banking of water. I mean, those are the kinds of legislation that you just love to see because it's going to benefit not just the here and now, but it's going to be a benefit in the long term. I think that's remarkable.
Well, and I think what's important to understand here, and which is why these bills went through, is that these are nonpartisan issues. Water is not a partisan issue. Seniors and children are not a partisan issue. Republicans, Democrats, giraffes, we all have kids. We all have seniors. You know, it doesn't matter what the party is. It's the – and again, it comes back to Steve is the guy for the people. And, you know, when you can break these issues down into nonpartisan issues, then you're able to get things done in Tallahassee because it just makes good sense. It's just good government.
Well, in addition to the primary coming up, are there any other events that our listeners can go to and hear Steve speak? Are there any debates or roundtables coming up?
Well, you know, we've been working on those things. The DEC, I believe, is not having a meeting in August, which baffles me, but that's another story. But I do also want to speak about some of the other races that I'm working on, if that's okay.
Sure. Please, go ahead.
One of the races that is very, very important to all of us is the supervisor of elections race. And in that race, we have Susan Booker, who is our current incumbent. I've known Susan Booker for years. I worked on her last campaign. She has worked tirelessly, just tirelessly, to make sure that every vote is counted. Yes, we've been on the radar with some issues, but those issues don't belong to her. They're technological issues. A lot of listeners, again, may not be aware that the state of Florida, the Secretary of State's office, actually picks your voting equipment. They give you a slate of vendors, supposedly a slate of vendors, that you can choose from. And in this state, we only have two. So Susan Booker is dealing with equipment that was decided upon by her predecessor, not her, and she actually went before the commission and begged them not to buy this stuff. And I was there for that meeting. But they went ahead, the county commission said, well, you're not the supervisor yet, this guy is, we're going with his recommendation. And so we had to buy into a lot of voting equipment that really didn't work for us. And so, yes, there have been issues, but she has procedures in place that catches these things because she knows that technology fails. And if technology fails, we have a backup plan. And I think that's what voters really need to know about Susan Booker, is that she doesn't just take what the computer says as gospel. She has a way to back into those numbers to make sure those numbers are right. And if they're not right, you know, anybody else on the planet could hide it and not say anything. But, I mean, that whole thing that happened in Wellington was, I mean, she brought a holy hell rain of fire down on herself by going, hey, I found a problem. And so everybody crucified her for it. I love her for it because anybody else would have buried it under a pile of sand. And so voting for Susan Booker on August 14th, or if you're an early voter or an absentee voter, she cares about this. This is something she's very passionate about.
Well, it sounds like government in the open, in the sunshine, and that's exactly what we want for our public servants.
Well, instead we crucify her in the press for that, which to me makes no sense. So you know, I just want folks to know about Susan Booker, and I would ask for their vote for her because I think she's doing a fabulous job, and she really deserves to be sent back to the office. She really, really does.
Diana, can you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with her campaign and how they can help
her? Absolutely. They can go to www.susanbooker.com. www.susanbooker, and her last name is spelled B-U-C-H-E-R.com.
Well, she did wonderful things as a legislator, and it'll be good to see her back there again.
I absolutely would love to see her. Another race I'm working on is Judge Garrison. He is a judge that's running for a seat. He's been around a very, very long time. He's a good judge. You know, the judicial races, you know, it's really funny. Judges have a funny way that they have to run. They really can't go out and raise money for themselves like regular candidates do. They either have to put in their own money or they have to go out and get a committee of people that will go out as his surrogate to go get the money. It's all very strange. You know, they want judges to be on a higher level as far as ethics and things, and so they don't really want judges out there campaigning, which I really thought was strange. But Ed Garrison has 30 years of judicial experience on the bench. He also does mediation and conflict resolution as a practice because he's a part-time judge right now. But he's a Supreme Court certified mediator in the civil court and in family court. And he is approved by the Supreme Court as an instructor for mediator education. So, I mean, he's an excellent judge, and I think we should give him this, the seat and let him continue serving. And the other race I'm working on is Pete Carney for tax collector. Pete has got a very, very large educational background in finance, as well as he's also a lawyer. And he is running against the current incumbent, Ann Gannon. Pete is working real hard to go out there and meet the people and, you know, make his case. He has a former tax collector of Palm Beach County from back in 2006. He's also the former deputy counsel for the state treasurer of the state of Massachusetts. He's also a real estate attorney and also a tax specialist. He hails from Princeton University. He's got a degree in economics there, Boston College. He has a law degree there, and also Boston University. And so these are the folks I'm working for, and I think it's going to be an interesting primary. And I've seen data with regard to absentee ballots, which I think is very, very pivotal and important for Democrats. It used to be Republicans killed us in absentee ballot voting. I mean, killed us, and this has always been a statewide problem. The Republicans always had a very good program for getting people out to vote absentee. This election is the first election I've ever seen where Democrats are beating Republicans in big numbers on absentee vote requests, which I think is just great because it's either absentee early, and Democrats always beat them in early voting. So having us gain some ground on the absentee side is really a big move.
Well, that's really good to hear. Very good to hear. I know there was quite a bit of talk about that up this way, too. I'm in the Martin County area, and all the local Democrats were encouraged to sign up for absentee voting. Let me ask you another question. You know, you're a person who's been committed for a long time to work in the process, to see good Democrats get elected. And I know you're a hands-on kind of person who works directly with these campaigns, who's going out to these meetings. I want to ask you, as a campaign professional, as a person who's really committed to the Democratic process, what's your reaction when you see these Republican legislators across the country putting additional burdens time and time again in the way to make voting more difficult? What's your professional reaction to that, as well as your reaction as a citizen?
Well, my reaction as a citizen is that it really makes me sad. You know, I don't believe the founders ever expected that voting was going to be made more difficult. And it saddens me that we have legislators up there that would actually do this. And a lot of these things essentially are a poll tax. I mean, and it's just, you know, it has some other moniker. For example, in the 2008 election, that's when the first voter ID, picture ID thing came into play, was during the Obama election. And I was very concerned because I know there's a lot of folks in the African-American communities that could not, they don't drive, they don't have a photo ID. And so they were going to be turned away at the polls. And these are, some of these folks were elderly, and they've been voting for, you know, 30 years or 50 years or whatever. And so I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to, you know, the Driver's License Bureau has a mobile bus. And I said, I'm going to land that thing in Riviera Beach, which is a very large swath of African-American voters, and get them IDs. And they were $3 a piece. For you to get a photo ID in Florida, it was $3. So we got the IDs funded, we landed the bus in the City Hall parking lot, and a lot of people got photo IDs. Well, I guess they fixed that following session, because this was when Marco Rubio exited after being Speaker of the House in Florida. He exited and went on to the Senate. And by the way, he didn't raise taxes, he raised fees, and he'll tell you that. So voter ID, or not, you know, picture IDs from the division of motor vehicles went from $3 to $25. So you can see, you know, they saw that requiring the voter ID wasn't good enough, or the picture ID was not good enough, because at $3 it was hattable, you know. So they made sure that the following session it went up to $25, and so it was a little more sketchy whether or not you're going to get funding for that.
What was wrong with long form political questionnaires and literacy tests, right?
Well, you know, again, as far as I'm concerned, this is a poll tax with a moniker that's called photo ID. And these kinds of things sadden me because I don't really think that's what this country is about. But we have – our political landscape has changed to such a degree where – you know, and this is left and right. It's win at any cost. And, again, the people in the middle just get lost in the sauce. And as the right moves further right, and the left, quite honestly, moves further right, because there's trends in that as well. You know, you're seeing a lot more blue dogs coming out of the woodwork than normal. And for me, it seems that, when you have lobbyists by the thousands, you have like 4-1 representative in Congress, and even in the legislature here, where you have, you know, lobbyists just hammering these guys all day long, and we'll get you contributions. So it's all about the reelection campaign. It's all about, you know, your whole political campaign. The barometer is how much did you raise, and are you viable? And that's how you end up with endorsements from all these different big organizations. They look at the bank account and they say, oh, well, he raised this much and this guy raised this much. Well, this guy, obviously, he's viable because he's got more money. And so it really doesn't matter about issues. It doesn't really matter about what their platforms are. It matters about how much money they raised. And this is not just the Citizens United thing. I mean, this has been going on here in Florida before Citizens ever came to be. I mean, the lobbyists can pay for all kinds of things. And I'm not saying all lobbying is bad. There's some lobbying going on up in Tallahassee that's advocacy lobbying, and a lot of it's unpaid. I mean, I myself have gone to Tallahassee as an unpaid lobbyist for Equality Florida, you know. But there's a lot of lobbying that's going on that's just really funding reelection campaigns, and incumbency based on that is not good for the people.
Yep, that's for sure. You know, as we're approaching another election cycle, and we keep hearing more and more and more about all this fundraising, this money you were talking about, whether it's coming from lobbyists directly or it's going to these mysterious Crossroads GPS and that sort of thing. You know, do you see the citizen participant is basically locked out of the system now? Or are you seeing still enough people who can pull together the resources and without big backing participate in the system? Or is it pretty much locked out now?
Well, no, we're not locked out. I mean, it's all strategy. Yes, you can run a lot of campaigns on TV and you can shoot mail and money funds that. You know, you could have candidates that could, or you know, advocacy people putting stuff on mail pieces that, you know, shoot into people's mailbox. They don't know if it's true or not. For me, what really matters is ground game and online game. I think the internet has changed the way campaigns are run now. Email blasts are a hell of a lot cheaper than mail pieces. A Facebook page could get the word out because of the, you know, 6 degrees of separation. For instance, when you look at the day that the internet shut down, where it was a blackout over the bills in Congress that were going to regulate the internet,
right?
That was power, and I was hoping that people would wake up to that power. If you can get your message out, that's what campaigns are about. It's not about anything else to win or lose, except getting your message to people. And so you have a ground game, and that's a lot of places where we fall short, because ground game is the hardest. It's real work. It's knocking doors. It's pounding the pavement. A lot of people don't like to do it, especially here in Florida, because it's 109 degrees in the shade, and we have a big base of retirees. So if there's a way to be able to utilize online campaigns, you know, Care2 petitions have gone, they're viral. You see a Care2 petition, if you filled one out, you'd do it again. You know, so there's ways to capture some of this imagination online. And if you can get a ground game going, you can beat the money. But it takes work. It takes Obama proved this in 2008. You had kids on the ground, and it takes young people because, you know, in a state like Florida, you're going to die in this heat otherwise. But, you know, getting young people engaged. These guys need to pick up the ball. I have a 21-year-old daughter. I drill this into her head all the time. You know, one day I'm not going to be able to do this anymore, and it's going to be up to you to do this. And I think the young Democrats here in Palm Beach County have done some very great things in that arena. I mean, they did a whole email campaign about voting naked. Go ahead and vote naked or vote in your underwear. That's the other thing that they've done, and it's the promotion of absentee ballot voting.
Uh-huh.
So you need young people engaged. You need a ground game. You can beat money if you can organize well.
Well, thank you so much. Let me ask you, I know you answered this question once for me, but we've got new listeners tonight that I want to hear about it. It's important to me to hear those spark stories. It's so difficult. We live such complicated lives. We have pulled in so many directions. It's hard enough to make a living. But you've made time in your life to try to make this a better world. And I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what got you up out of your busy life to participate and to work so hard to make the ability for more progressives to get elected. Could you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. I think it was probably the Bush administration that really moved me into action. When I watched my friends sending their kids over to Iraq and Afghanistan. In fact, one of my daughter's boyfriends from high school went over as a Marine to Afghanistan and got his leg shut off. You know, so when I saw the wars going on, and when I saw the profiteering going on, and when I saw the direction that Congress was heading, I mean, the whole Karl Rove playbook of how to disenfranchise voters through vote caging and the profiteering with all these, you know, the military-industrial complex, you know, and our kids just get killed over there in the wars really kicked me in the high gear because I was like, you know what, we got to get off this. You know, this is – to have these guys making all this money and to sacrifice sons and daughters and blood and treasure for this nightmare to me was just unbelievable. I think the Iraq War really pushed me over the edge. And I felt that we needed more people in office that went back to basics, went back to taking care of the people. When I think about the numbers of the dollars that we've spent between Iraq and Afghanistan that could have been spent on hungry children in this country or hungry families or families that are homeless, these are the things that, you know, separate us from the rest of the world, and we stopped taking care of our own, and there's something wrong with that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me. I know you're probably exhausted, running on fumes. I want to thank you for taking the time to join us. You want to give Steve Perman's contact information one more time?
Yes. Please go to www.believeinsteve.com. He is very dedicated to the territory, and I really want to send him back to Tallahassee, and I hope that after your listeners heard him tonight, they're going to want to send him back there too.
Well, thanks again, Diana. You have a real good night.
Thank you for having me.
Take a deep breath, kiddo. You did a good job.
Yeah, I'm trying. Take care and thank you again.
Okay, bye-bye, Diana.
Bye-bye.
Another great progressive activist and campaigner, the incomparable Diana Demarest. Just a great woman with the nerves of steel and a constitution to match. God us bless her. Some more news while we're waiting for our next guest. The 1% wants your Social Security and Medicaid, and Stephen Perlstein is trying to help. Steve Perlstein, Washington Post business columnist, often writes insightful pieces on the economy. Not today. The thrust of his piece is that we should all be hopeful that a group of incredibly rich CEOs can engineer a coup. And while the rest of us are wasting our time worrying about whether Barack Obama or Mitt Romney are going to sit in the White House next 4 years, Perlstein tells us approvingly that these honchos are scurrying through the back doors in Washington trying to carve out a deficit deal. The plan is we'll all get the rich folks deal regardless of who wins the election. This is via the Washington Post. Difficult to imagine a more contemptuous attitude toward democracy. The deal is this gang, led by Morgan Stanley director Erskine Bowles of the Cat Food Commission, is hatching will inevitably include some amount of tax increases and a large budget cut. Top of the list, as Perlstein proudly tells us, are cuts to Social Security and Medicare. At a time when we've seen an unprecedented transfer of income from the top 1%, these deficit warriors are placing a top priority on snatching away a portion of Social Security checks that average, $1,200 a month. Yes, the security certainly needs this. The most likely to cut is Social Security is a reduction in the annual cost of living adjustment of 0.3%. While that might sound trivial, the effect accumulates through time, and after 10 years, a typical check will be about 3% lower. After 20 years, it'll be 6% lower. And after 30 years, it'll be about 9% lower. Hey, can you say 10%? Social Security amounts to 90% or more of the income for one-third of seniors. For this group, they proposed cut in benefits would be considerably larger share of their income than the higher taxes faced by someone earning $300,000 a year as a result of the repeal of the Bush tax cuts on high-income earners. The latter is supposed to be a big deal. Therefore, the proposed cuts to Social Security are also a big deal. Also, maybe you've heard about the new eminent domain ripoff, the latest in Wall Street flavored and favored fixes for the terrible economy brought on by, hey, all those liar loans. Okay, this new proposal to use eminent domain to buy up underwater homes and refinance them has been getting a lot of publicity in intellectual circles. The unorthodox fix for the housing market is already happening. That would be the REO to rental revolution, where investment firms buy up foreclosed properties in mass quantities after repossession and then flip them into the rental market. Entire firms are being built with this business model. We know that over 40% of the city of Oakland's foreclosed homes have been purchased by investors. That isn't prospective. It's already happening. Setting aside for a moment the potential problems of creating a large swath of hedge fund slumlords, as well as the possibility of raising entire neighborhoods with new development, the theory for investors is they can generate a steady stream of rental payments that will eventually dwarf the foul sale price they paid for foreclosed property. And with that, I'm going to pause because we've got our next guest up. Hold on just 1 second. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Ms. Kristen Jacobs, candidate. Kristen,
hello.
Good evening.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the phone with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you back. Listen, how's the campaign going?
I'm really excited. We've had such a tremendous outpouring of support coming out of Palm Beach County, in addition to the support we have in Broward County. I'm really encouraged by what's been happening.
Oh, congratulations. I just hear all kinds of good things about the campaign.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that, too. It's beyond my ears and into yours. That's good news.
Well, you know, you have such great qualifications, your environmental work, your work in, should we say, county government. You just bring so much to the table. It's going to be so wonderful to have someone like you in Tallahassee. Let's skip ahead for a few months in our fantasy here for a second and tell us what are the first kinds of things you want to start working on when you get up there?
Oh, I love this question because I've been asked a couple of times, you are appointed to different committees when you get to Congress. Which committees would I most like to serve on? And the first one, well, actually, it's hard to define between the two, but the first one would be either transportation or energy. There are amazing opportunities, and I think energy kind of weighs out, by the way. There are amazing opportunities for our country to advance, and particularly in South Florida, to advance clean energy and to become self-sustaining when it comes to the fuel and the energy needed to power our country in the future. I look at what President Kennedy did to set a goal out that in one decade that we would be on the moon. Why is it that we can't do that for energy, that we would be completely energy independent as a country in 10 years? There are a variety of rules in which if we just tweak them and some outright changed rules altogether in law, we could make significant advances on that front. So I'd really love the idea of being with energy. The other thing would be the issues of transportation. I, like many people today, are very frustrated that the only way generally to move around, particularly the South Florida area and large urban areas throughout the country, is that you have to own a car. And as the price point of an automobile continues to climb higher and higher, we know that there are young people who just don't have the ability to buy one. They can't afford the insurance or the maintenance or the cost of payments. You have elderly who can maybe afford those things but are not of an age that they're able to drive. And then you have people by choice that would like to find an alternative mode to move around the communities, and they need to be given that opportunity to do so. We often hear that transit and transportation projects, streetcars, trains, buses, they all cost money, and I kind of bristle at that because I really look at those kinds of investments in our infrastructure as just that, as an investment, not as a cost. Whereas a road or a bridge or any of the other types of infrastructure that we typically build for government don't yield monies back. We don't, for some reason, the general public and many policymakers don't think of that as a cost. They think of it as an investment. So I believe we need to move both of those in the same direction. For every car that we don't need in a household, we free up around $7,000 to $10,000 a year in a person's home that could be used for myriad other things. It could be education. It could be just simply being able to save up and buy a home in the first place. So, looking at the issues, and of course, there's the whole outside surrounding issues associated with that of being able to be cleaner in our environment and making cleaner choices. So, I look at those two committees as my first goals up there. But then there's other things like water and climate change that are truly issues affecting South Florida that I would also like to be involved in.
Wow, that sounds like an absolutely fantastic agenda, and you come so well equipped to do that. Why don't we give our listeners a chance to help you out? Why don't you give us your web address and maybe a phone number to campaign headquarters or just the web address so that, okay, that people who want to support you can get in touch with you and give some support or volunteer some time.
Okay, the web address is simple as can be. It's it's kristinjacobs.com. It's spelled KristinJacobs, JACOBS.com. And you threw me with the campaign office number. If you give me a few seconds, by the time we get to the end of our interview, I'll have
sure,
that number.
Sure.
It's the one I don't call often myself, so I apologize. I don't know it by heart.
Oh, that's perfectly fine. Don't worry about it. Let me ask you this. You know, we're in the middle of the summer. You know, we're at least seeing some rain. What are you hearing about the water supply in Florida? How are we doing? How's the lake?
Well, there are myriad issues facing Lake Okeechobee. First to understand is that the Army Corps of Engineers several years ago, by prompting by the South Florida Water Management District, went out and took a look at the levee and understood that it is having some structural issues. And as a result of that, listed it as one of six levees or dams in the country that they labeled as being in imminent danger of failure. And as a result of that, they decided that the only way to keep the integrity of it was to drop the water down and not to allow the lake to get higher than 17 feet. So because of that, it has meant a huge problem for the Water Management District and other areas south, because it means that they are constantly having to jettison any waters that come above that mark out to the east and west, that, you know, sends it to the east and west sides of the coast of Florida. So
sure.
Each time that we have rain events, there is a big issue associated with the lake and how it affects us. The lake's health probably affects Palm Beach County much greater than it does here in Broward County. Broward County's only taken a water delivery from Lake O once in over 20 years. So the bigger issue for water quality and water quantity for us in South Florida in general is the issues of sea level rise and the issues you're hearing a lot of now about drought and drier conditions. We are experiencing that here in Broward County. There is a two-day-a-week water restriction mandatory put in place for year-round, not associated with the drought, but just understanding that it is the best thing for us to do. I know that Palm Beach County has looked at that issue and is still contemplating whether to go to a mandatory rate or not. They have yet to decide that. But overall, when you consider that we are so close to the water that we need in Broward County and in Palm Beach County, water issues continue to be of a big concern, not just the amount of water that we have, but also the quality of the water. There has been a lot of arguments about the EPA's hard-fisted approach to the state of Florida's water quality issues in saying that we needed to deal with a numeric water quality criteria. Broward County is the only county in the state of Florida that has had numeric water quality standards since the 70s. And we have not, and with 1,800 linear miles of canal systems, you can imagine every home, every business, every school, it's all of us have our water draining into this canal system. And
sure,
the potential for water that wasn't the cleanest of clean is huge with the county as crowded as Broward with 1.8 million people. But instead, we have some of the cleanest water in the state of Florida across the country, and it's due to the standards that we have based on this criteria. It's the same criteria that the EPA is wishing for the entire state to take on and has been working with them and the state legislature and the governor's office for the last 12 years. I think Broward sits as a good example about how the sky is not going to fall and economic calamity beset any local government when they have to do the right thing by keeping clean water. We shine as an example there. And only time will tell. The EPA has decided to work with the state, and I support absolutely what the EPA is trying to do. And I think others will finally come on board as time goes by.
Let me ask you a difficult technical question, and if you need to beg off, that's perfectly fine, because I know you don't work full-time as a water consultant. But a question I was wondering is, you know, given the closeness of the ocean, I was wondering, is there anyone out there sampling the water table? Would that be water management? Is that on a county or a regional basis? Do we have any sense of what's going on with the water table?
Well,
is anyone collecting information on that, do you think?
There is a ton of information that's being collected constantly, and we could really get into the weeds here, which I know we don't have the time to do.
Sure, well, some other time maybe.
That what is happening is there are a variety of tests that are taken both offshore to look at water quality, how clean is the water and what's going on. Those happen regularly by both Palm Beach and Broward County, and all of our counties look at those studies. Some of our counties spend extra monies within our own general fund to continue testing beyond what the state requires to understand the quality. We're also looking at the issues of where the water is, and that really relates to where your saltwater intrusion line is.
Right.
We drill cores, and we know where we have lost wells or where the saltwater intrusion line has moved inland, and we know where our wells are still coming up clean. So somewhere between where the wells, the tests that show where the wells are clean and where the areas that we've lost them to saltwater intrusion, that's where we kind of see that line shifting. And what we're seeing over time, it is absolutely migrating inland. And that is due to, in essence, how many straws can you put into the soil and pull water up. The more that you do that, the more that you draw the salt water in, because the salt water and fresh water kind of sit on each other like a wedge. And an interesting thing that was done recently in the city of Pompano Beach was to increase through reuse the waters, and Palm Beach has a fabulous reputation and record with reuse, because when they were being developed, they had developers come in and build many of these systems. But the idea was, let's take a look at what happens when we superhydrate on the east side through reuse and at the same time reduce the amount of water that we're pulling from eastern wells and increase reliance on the western wells. And they saw a remarkable thing happen, and that was that the saltwater intrusion line began to recede back toward the ocean. Granted,
it takes
10 times longer than it did to move inland, but we know that we can affect it by our behavior.
Super. Let me ask you one other development-related question. You know, I was always troubled when they talked about shovel-ready projects as being so important. I think that kind of strikes me like, so that the idiots can understand, we're going to do this shovel-ready. And what it does is kind of lock out long-term thinking, long-term projects. And I was wondering if you had any reaction to this kind of shovel-ready answer to long-term public investment?
You know, the whole idea with the monies that were being made available to local governments to jumpstart the economy and get people back to work was a great idea, and it harkens back to Roosevelt. And the idea was great. The problem came when you started to look at shovel-ready projects because of the myriad ways in which we are using public dollars and the transparency associated with those dollars. It means the whole bidding process becomes very complicated and very unwieldy, and it doesn't mean that you're going to get to these projects in the amount of time that the federal government was putting these dollars down so it could be spent. They wanted money that was hitting the streets quick. So in order for that to happen, guess what? They called it shovel-ready, meaning that you'd already jumped through the permitting processes and all of those other things, and these dollars are ready to go grow jobs now. What we did in Broward County, though, and so that was kind of a problem with how to spend them, but we did something really cool in Broward County with it, and that was we took a project that was already funded and sitting several years out, ready to be funded through our MPO, the Metropolitan Planning Organization, and that was a bridge to connect Palm Beach and Broward County along Dixie Highway. What we did was we took that project, we moved forward and used the stimulus dollars to fund that, while at the same time freeing up projects that rippled through all 31 cities in the county. It was a fantastic opportunity to take and measure up to the requirement for, you know, jump in there, get this project off the ground now, and understanding how difficult that could have been, and at the same time jump-starting projects and moving them in so that those projects now have funding that's going to extend 8 years beyond that initial investment of the federal government. So there was a way to do it and do it smart, and I think in Broward's case, we were really, it was a fantastic experience to be called in for an emergency meeting with all 31 cities at the table as well as the county and work together to do something that was granted dollars that were going to benefit one side of the county while figuring out how we could then use those dollars throughout the rest of the county long term. It can be done. We did it. And I just think there are other areas maybe that don't have the kind of cooperation that we do to honor each other's opinions and sit down and really hash through the best ways to use this opportunity, these dollars that came to our community. And the result is that not only do these projects continue now for the next 8 years, but we have a bridge between two really fast-growing counties, Palm Beach and Broward, in a project that was set to happen for many, many years in the future. And it's done now. It's opened, and people are driving on it.
Well, Kristen, I have to tell you that when you bring that kind of that kind of incredibly innovative, positive, long-term thinking to your next seat in government, I'm really looking forward to that day. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with your soon to be with your soon election. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Come back again,
to be here.
Okay?
And the number, in case anybody would like to volunteer, we can use as much help as anybody's able to give us in this campaign.
Sure.
Is 561-907-8222.
Go ahead, give us your web address again, too.
It's KristenJacobs.com, KristinJacobs.com.
Okay, best of luck, Kristen.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be
here. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got our last guest all queued up. Mario, welcome, sir.
How you doing, Rick?
Very good, sir. Very good. Wow, I'm so appreciate you taking time away from your busy schedule. I know you're out there in the field with a wonderful candidate. So what's on your plate, buddy?
Well, so we have a couple weeks to go. We've just started voting. I'm in Washington State for Darcy Berner. It's a 100% vote-by-mail state. So everybody has their ballots in their hands right now. And so it's an interesting, strategically, it's interesting to deal with the fact that everyone gets force-fed a ballot. The question is whether they choose to use it or not. And so that's completely different than the dynamics we deal with in Florida and around the country. So that's different. The other dynamics are pretty much what I'm used to dealing with. We have a strong progressive candidate in Darcy Berner who has stood up and fought for things like Social Security and Medicare and taken on the right, the left, and the center, when necessary, to defend those values against very wealthy candidates, against a Tea Party Republican. This is also an open election, so like California, where you saw all the ballots, all the candidates on one ballot. We have the same thing here in Washington. So there'll be seven candidates on the ballot, a Tea Party Republican named John Koster, an independent who isn't really campaigning, and then five Democrats, including Darcy.
Oh, my goodness.
So we've got a lot of fun going on out here, and we're just doing our best to make sure we get all our votes in and advance to the general election, where we'll be taking on the Tea Party Republican, who has said some wonderful things like there's no such thing as the Defense of Marriage Act, and that he believes in climate change, just not that man has anything to do with it.
Well, I have to laugh because, of course, we've got that carpetbagger West who's moved up to my area. So I don't want to take too much time up with your campaign there in Washington State, although I am curious about one thing. What kind of participation level do they get with this vote by mail? Is it is there statistics in there yet, or is it relatively new
well,
kind of?
Well, so they've been doing it for 6 or 7 years now here. The statistics show that overall turnout is a little bit better than in other states. History would suggest, if you took out 2012, took 2012 out of the data set of all of the primaries around the country, history would suggest somewhere between 47 and 49% turnout in this primary. But given what we've seen across the country and given what we're seeing in the district, we're expecting turnout to be a bit lower than that, somewhere between 40 and 45%. Now, that's still pretty high. I don't know what Florida's turnout for the primary is expected to be this year, having been here in Connecticut for and around the country for the rest of the year. But turnout across the country has been very low. We saw the Ilya Shaman race in Illinois was just 20,000 short of expectation in terms of turnout. We saw the turnout in the California primaries was very low. We saw the turnout in New Mexico was much lower than expected. So we're expecting it to be down a bit.
I see. Well, I know that while you have a national career working on politics across the country, you're very committed and very concerned about politics here in Florida. And
absolutely.
You and I have talked from time to time, and you're a very passionate progressive. And, you know, there's always, one of the things about the progressive movement, there's all kinds of different tactical suggestions and approaches in mind. Tell me, what's your thinking about the state of politics in Florida now?
Well, I mean, you've got a few good candidates that really should make us optimistic. You got Keith Fitzgerald running for Vern Buchanan's seat, who last quarter outraised Buchanan, which people thought was unheard of. And
that's
then
fantastic.
Coupled with the fact that Buchanan had to spend most of his money on legal
lawyers,
fees and returning contributions. I love Keith Fitzgerald. I wish him the best. Alan Grayson looks like he's pretty solid for that seat. The Republicans were more or less afraid of him and drew him a nice friendly seat there. then you have the two women that are running in the seat Alan West was afraid to run for. Kristen Jacobs, who was just on the program, and Lois Frankel. And then you've got Patrick Murphy running against Alan West, and he's been doing quite well with money. He's been getting some interest. I would like to see better out of the South Florida races. I think we made some missteps there early in the year, and last year there were some dramas that should have been avoided and candidates that should have done some more work, and I'd like to see us go back to what happened in 06 and 08, where candidates got in early, did the work early, and that's what helped us win so many seats in those elections.
You know, I'm sure it must have been as big a disappointment to you as it was to me when I heard that there were several seats that went completely unopposed by Democrats. And,
yeah, it's really just, it's not okay. We need to be doing better. The party needs to be doing more to recruit. And it seems like with a state with millions and millions of people, millions and millions of Democrats, we should be able to field more candidates and win more elections.
If I'm not mistaken, there's more Democrats registered in Florida than there are Republicans.
that's been the math since 08, maybe even earlier than that. I know that Obama's campaign registered a ton of people in 08, and we're seeing the growth in Hispanic and other minority populations growing rapidly. I mean, that's when you look at the greater Orlando area, we should be gaining ground there. Obviously, South Florida, and then in Jacksonville, one of the things people didn't really take note of in 2010 was that, well, Alex Sink didn't perform as well as we would like statewide. She overperformed tremendously in Jacksonville. And Alvin Brown won the mayor's race there. That's mm-hmm. a seat or an area of the state where we should be picking up Democratic seats. I know Nancy Soderbergh is running for state senate out there. I wish her the best, but we need to be putting forward candidates earlier and go after those areas and doing more to build the infrastructure from the state party level down to the county parties to, you know, on-the-ground organizations.
I'd like to ask you another question that, to me, strikes at the heart of our representative democracy. We've seen legislature after legislature across the country held by Republicans putting obstacle after obstacle after obstacle in the way of voters, whether it be photo ID or, you know, chasing these phantom illegal voters. How does that strike you as a campaign professional, a person whose life work is the democratic process?
I mean, it's really remarkable that one side of the aisle, one side of the philosophy spectrum, has decided that they can't win competing on an even playing field. So the way that they're going to aim for victory is by eliminating members of our country, citizens, from the voting process. If we can get it so that they can't vote, then we can win more elections. That says a lot, in my opinion, about where we are as a country and as a democracy. And we've seen some court rulings in recent days that have struck down some of these laws. We need to be keep pushing it down that alley through the courts. We also need to be fighting it by making sure that we're running more campaigns for state senate, for state house, for Congress. We're not uncontesting these races. When we go after them, we put people in, then they can't enact these ridiculous laws. What Rick Scott's doing down there, basically presuming guilt and eliminating people from the rolls, and then it turns out that they're actually valid citizens that should have the right to vote, that should be a crime. Whether it's Rick Scott or some other member of his government or the supervisor of elections that's allowing it to happen at the county level, somebody needs to be held accountable for taking away people's right to vote.
I asked a couple of legislators about that on the air, and they said, to the best of their knowledge, there was nothing illegal about it. It was bad form. It was not right, but they couldn't think of a way of calling it illegal. I mean, I just think it's an absolute – I mean, you hate to throw the word treasonous around, but it strikes at the very root of representative democracy. If you're preventing
people
from voting –
If it isn't illegal, let's make it illegal.
Well, unfortunately, the Republicans in Tallahassee certainly won't do that here. But, I mean
– It seems like an initiative we should be able to pass. I mean, I would like to see the polling data on that one. Let's give it a shot.
I mean, here, there's stories on the air almost every day. This 60-year-old, that 70-year-old, this veteran, that veteran. You know, people who you know, whether through economic reasons or other healthcare reasons, you know, haven't had a picture ID. You know, they've actually made it more difficult just to get a driver's license in Florida now, with, I'm sure, the end game being that that's one less person that is going to be able to vote.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, it when one side decides that they can't win fairly and they have to change the parameters of the game, kind of rig the rules. That's what Republicans have been doing for 30 years. It's what Newt Gingrich did when he became Speaker of the House. He knew that they would have trouble passing the laws that they wanted to pass and driving the agenda they wanted to drive, so he changed the rules. And we saw it in the Senate where when the Republicans had the majority, they needed 51 votes to pass anything, or 50 votes plus Dick Cheney. And when Democrats took power, we need 60 votes to pass anything. And that doesn't seem to be an acceptable set of rules. We need to get back to parity in the rules, and we need Democrats to stand up and fight for what we believe in.
I keep hoping that I'm going to see some kind of fight in the National Democrats, and I have yet to find that thing that I'm looking for. I'd like to see a filibuster actually be a filibuster, but unfortunately, that's not my call. Go ahead.
The first step is let's elect some leaders, some candidates that will do that. I'm working for Darcy Berner for just that reason. I would point out Rick Nolan in Minnesota is running in the 8th District against Chip Kravach, and Chris Donovan, who's running in Connecticut in the 5th District. These are folks who, when challenged, have risen to the occasion and demonstrated that they're willing to take on whoever steps in the way of Democratic values. Nolan has repeatedly campaigned for candidates he believes in Iowa since from Ted Kennedy. He left Congress to campaign for Ted Kennedy, and way back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, he was a congressman in the 70s, left Congress to campaign for Kennedy, and was a big part of fighting for FISA to stop the immunity for those that were infringing on our rights, the big telecoms. And then Donovan's in Connecticut. He's been fighting for labor, for workers' rights his whole life. He passed some wonderful bills, marriage equality and family medical leave at the state level in Connecticut. He's done some great work there. And these guys are out there, but they're in primaries right now against Democrats who aren't necessarily willing to stand up for those values. That's what we're facing here in Washington, where Darcy's against a self-funder who has said that the problem with Democrats in Washington is they don't compromise enough. The problem, Democrats, she doesn't want to join the Progressive Caucus because Democrats aren't friendly enough to business. And the establishment has lined up behind her and her wallet. And
yeah.
So that's what we're up against. And we're fighting it out $14 at a time for our donations. Our average contribution is less than $40. And she put in over $1 million of her own money so far. She's booked something like $200,000 worth of TV during the Olympics. We won't have any TV in this campaign. She's got $200,000 just during the Olympics.
Well, let me turn to another topic of interest to many of us. I'm sure you observe the Romney campaign as I do, with a somewhat jaundiced eye. And I was wondering, if you were advising the Romney campaign, would you say they've released enough tax information?
I would say that every candidate has the, for federal office, has the obligation to release all information that demonstrates who they are to the American people, particularly when you're talking about the presidency, United States senators, congressmen. They should be filing financial disclosures. They should be releasing their taxes. It shows who they are and how they've behaved beyond just the rhetoric that they spew.
Yeah. It's interesting. I just watched the film about the Sarah Palin anointment on the television a little while earlier, and it was kind of like the ghost of Christmas past strolling across your grave. You know, it was pretty much a shuddering experience. And I have to wonder, given the problems that the Mitster has, what kind of VP is he going to go for? It's a pretty interesting thing. But if I was to ask you to give some advice to Florida voters, what would you say?
My advice to Florida voters would be to pay attention to what has happened over the last several years, and to think about where they want Florida to go in the future, which should be to a state that values education, innovation, looks at things like preserving the great natural resources that Florida has. If anybody thinks that the Republicans did well by the BP disaster, I don't know how that could be.
I want to thank you.
You've got people like Fitz, you've got Grayson, you've got Nancy Soderbergh up in North Florida, you've got whoever wins the Frankel Kristen Jacobs primary, you've got Patrick Murphy. There are options, and get off your butts, go knock on some doors, give $10. Instead of having a Starbucks tomorrow morning, take that $5 and go to Act Blue and give it to one of those candidates.
Well, thanks so much, Mario. Sure appreciate you taking away some time to talk to the listeners. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Keep up the good work. Bye-bye. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We've had some great guests. You've heard some good thoughts. And remember, it's going to be a better tomorrow because you're going to make it a better tomorrow. Thanks so much on behalf of myself and my co-producer, Mickey Royce. Thanks for being here. We're going to make it a better tomorrow.
What you